evening, everybody, and welcome to episode 108 of the Lion in Vienna Suite podcast, remains the university's greatest Bolton Wanderers podcast. Tonight I'm Chris, and I'm joined by Will, as usual. Will, good evening.
Good evening, Chris, how are you?
I'm excellent, thank you, mate, excellent. So how's your weekend been?
Yeah, it's been okay. A bit uneventful without football, but yeah, fine nonetheless.
It's better, isn't it? At least Wanderers didn't lose.
Oh, I know, yeah.
Makes a nice change,
it does.
We're also joined by special guest Chris Flanagan of 442 Magazine. Chris, good evening and thanks for joining us.
No problem, good evening.
Great stuff, very, very nice to have you on. Obviously, your esteemed magazine has been very popular with Wanderers fans on social media over the last few days. And so we'll no doubt touch on some of that storm as we've managed to get through things in a chronological order. So, with that in mind, we thought tonight we'd have you on to discuss the main subject of the book you wrote, Who Put the Ball in the Munich Net, which was a description of Wanderers' time in the UEFA Cup, which to all of us now seeing the present strife seems like a million years ago. Perhaps could you just introduce the listeners to yourself and just give a bit of an idea about how the book came to be?
I've obviously been a lifelong Bolton fan going back to, 1990s when I first started watching Bolton. And, there's no doubt that those two seasons in Europe were the highlight, of my time. And, I'd imagine most people's time following Bolton. It was just two remarkable seasons. It seemed like something that, I've been a journalist now myself for 14, 15 years, so it seemed like something that, it would be really interesting to write about, and it proved to be. Obviously, it's, like I said, I went to every European game, home and away, so I had those memories myself, and kind of spoke to a lot of the players and managers involved as well as part of the book, and it was fascinating. I love writing about it, and I hope people enjoyed reading it.
I certainly did. I've got a copy here and I've got a copy when I go away as well to take to remind myself of happier times. I mean, I look back through some of my notes from back when I got it. In fact, I managed to get a preview copy sent through when I was writing more frequently for the website, when we used to get things like that before everyone fell out with everybody. It was a cracking read. I mean, harking back, I remember that the anecdotes you were telling about Nicky Hunt talking about JJ Kotcher in the nip. the behind-the-scenes fight between Speed and Mate. I wonder if you could perhaps enlighten the listeners on one or two of those, and any particular favourite moments or conversations you had with players, because it's always good to hear what these people are like face-to-face, especially during the time. But at the moment, we don't really know a lot about the current team. There's not a lot of media intrusion or media interest, I guess, going that deep into the experiences. I guess that is a sort of symptom of where we are in the league and our troubles at the minute. But anything that stands out to you? I know it's been a few years since, but very interested to hear what you think.
Well, I mean, the first thing to say about it is, obviously, when I started writing this book and mostly wanted to include, the players and managers that were involved, it was really telling how many of them were just, really happy to talk about it. I mean, obviously, it was, for most of them, it was one of the highlights of their career, so you're talking about happy times. But, I did get a real sense that so many of them just enjoyed talking about it. And still, even the ones, most of them had left Bolton by the time I did these interviews, but they all, it's so apparent, they all had so much love for the club. I mean, you go through the long list. I mean, people like Diouf, Stelios, Nicky Hunt, Kevin Nolan, Allardyce, Fast Tay, and a lot of other, Henry Pedersen, so many of them, in fact, all of them, you could really tell that kind of love they still have for Bolton. I remember having a good hours chat with Nicky Hunter about it all, and like you say about JJ, I think that was the League Cup semi final after the celebrations after the Villa game, I think at Villa Park and things like that. And one of the ones that stands out for me was Diouf, because he still doesn't do that many interviews really, so I wasn't quite sure whether my chance of actually getting to him. But he was at Leeds United at the time, so I contacted Leeds. And I got an email back pretty much straight away saying, LS Diouf has just been told about your request. He's just stood up in the Leeds canteen and told all the other players that he's a legend at Bolton. and he said he'd be delighted to do it. So, I ended up kind of a week or two later having nearly an hour with him at the hotel at the stadium. And he was great. He had such great stories. And when you see people like that who don't necessarily do a lot of media interviews, who were so happy to talk about it, that was quite telling of just how special that time was to all of them, really.
And again, speaking to Jeff once or twice in my own life, he's an absolutely fascinating guy. How did you find him? Because so I was a bit unsure the first time I ever spoke to him. The first time I ever spoke to him was on the night out, like a lot of people, I think, bumped into him on the various pubs and clubs about in town. I found him to be really engaging, really generous with his time. Just complete opposite to the opinion that you probably expect most football fans would have of the man.
Well, yeah, I mean, like you say, he comes across as someone that, if you get him in the right mood, he's great. Maybe if you don't get him in the right mood, he could be quite a bit different. But certainly that day, you know, he turned up. He seemed very happy to talk. I mean, like I say, he didn't. By no means did he have to do the interview at all, really, because you know he was busy with his own career at that point. But no, he came down. And he was just giving me loads of great stories and yeah he was really good. He was a better talker than I expected, actually, and he was probably one of the most enjoyable interviews I've ever done, because he was someone, I think, I mean, I can understand across the country people don't necessarily like him so much, but I think in Bolton he's so popular, and he's certainly one of my favourite Bolton players in terms of watching the club, and for him to then be so generous with his time and you know, be so friendly and give such a nice interview. You know, I think that was one of the most enjoyable ones I've ever done, really.
Oh, fantastic. Was there anybody that you wanted to speak to that perhaps you didn't, or you weren't able to, or maybe didn't want to talk to you?
I think there was only one I can think of, and that was Sammy Lee. And obviously, you know, I can understand that to an extent, because he managed Bolton for the Robert Nitschke games in the first round of the second season. And obviously at that time, things weren't going well for him, and Bolton only just about got through. So for the other managers, it was, you know, one of the highlights of their career. Even Gary Megson, which obviously turned out to be controversial in Europe, but at least he still had, like, Bayern Munich, which obviously he was proud of, and so he was happy to talk about that, and Atletico Madrid, of course. Whereas Sammy Lee, obviously, I think he just wanted to forget about that whole period managing Bolton, really.
Fair enough.
So yeah, he wasn't keen to talk, but I think he's the only one really who didn't want to talk.
Okay, well, I mean, his reasons seem perfectly fair enough, and I can imagine that had things been different, I'm sure he would have been obliging. But just to give a bit of context, it was in June of 2005 when Juve scored that famous goal away at Portsmouth to send Wanderers into Europe. I was looking back, doing a bit of research. We do a little bit of research every now and then to see, and there's the league table that season. So we finished ahead of City. We were sixth. We were level on points with Liverpool, who had won the Champions League the year before, and only 3 points behind Everton, who qualified for Champions League third round. We had a cracking squad, an absolutely cracking squad. Some of the players, though, like Julio Cesar, again, so not one that made a massive impact on Wanderers, but someone who had a really good CV. The squad also contained Nolan and Gotti, Speed, Stelios, Henrik, Okocha, Gardner, Davies, Jaidi, Campo, Nicky Hunt, Hierro, Jufi, Jaskalainen, Vincent Candela, Tal Ben-Haim, Vaz Tay, Joey O'Brien and Fariga, just to name but a few.
All the legends.
Well, when you compare them against some of the current muck, it's just how perhaps we didn't appreciate at the time what an absolute golden age we were living through.
It's a slight contrast.
It is, isn't it? Ever so slight contrast. It was a season that, if I recall rightly, that Phil Brown left to take over at Derby. And so that meant Sammy Lee coming in. And Allardyce, of course, was linked strongly at the time with the England job. He took an interview and he was unsuccessful, which obviously had an impact on Wanderers as time went on. But that meant we entered the UEFA Cup the year after for the first time. So we were drawn with Lokomotiv Plovdiv, 19,000 at the Reebok that night as we won 2-1, Borghetti and Juve scored. And then an away win 2-0 in Bulgaria. Now, I didn't go to the away game, but Chris, perhaps you could give us a few of your memories from that particular one down on the seaside in Bulgaria.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's one of my most special matches watching Bolton, just the whole kind of experience. I mean, as soon as we got into the Premier League, I'd always kind of thought if we could one day get in Europe, that would be fantastic. And, Bulgaria may not be seen as the most glamorous place for a lot of people, but it really didn't matter. In fact, in a way, it was a place that most of us wouldn't have been to before, you know, on holidays and stuff like that. So it seems so different. And I actually quite enjoyed the fact that we did get somewhere so different. And, you know, certainly, you know, arriving in Bulgaria, you could sense the differences straight away. You've seen horse and carts on the streets and things like that, and thinking, yeah, I haven't seen anything like this before. But you know, then we went on to the coast, and you know, and it was a very nice area that sort of way. I mean, then But the city itself, I mean, we obviously, as you know, we played in Burgas in that first game, because quite a distance from Plovdiv, because obviously Plovdiv's stadium wasn't up to it for UEFA standards. And I just remember on the coach driving into Burgas, it's kind of quite an austere city with all these kind of former communist sort of tower blocks, and thinking, you know, this is just so different to anywhere I've been before, and I imagine for most Bolton fans would have been the case. And then the match, you know, was just an amazing experience. Just the fact, you know, there was, you know, what, probably around 2,000 Bolton fans there in the middle of Bulgaria, was just that in its own was an incredible thing, really, considering, you know, we'd never done anything like that before. And I think Amir Khan was there and things like that. And obviously, you know, we're 2-1 up from the first game. And then they scored to they were ahead on that point on away goals.
That's right.
And at that point, it was, you know, I think all of us there were thinking, oh no, this is going to be our European experience over in one game, which would have been such a shame. And obviously, you know, I wouldn't have been writing a book of
it would have been a lot shorter if nothing happened, I guess.
And then just to rescue it in those last 10 minutes, you know, with the own goal and then Nolan scoring, it's just, yeah, and then that's 10 of the best minutes of my time watching Bolton. Just the atmosphere in that away end when we turned it around and saved it and winning. Indeed. And all the players celebrating with the fans, and obviously then what it led to over the next, you know, two seasons in Europe. It was a hell of a significant 10 minutes.
It definitely was a hell of a place for that. I remember watching it coming home from work on Channel 5, I think it was. So that win took us through to the group stages. We had a tough group with Besiktas, Zenit St. Petersburg, Gimaraes and Sevilla. So looking back through the records of it, it wasn't the most sort of exciting draw, but exciting to Bolton fans, obviously, because of the freshness and the whole entire experience of being in Europe. Now, results-wise, we had three draws and a win. And the win, I'll never forget that night, in unbelievable circumstances against Zenit St. Petersburg, in the rain at the Reebok. Again, if you don't mind just giving us your memories and your experiences talking to anyone who was involved perhaps in those games to recall. It was one apiece against Besiktas with a goal from Borghetti, 1-0 against Zenit, as I said, with a goal from Stelios. Gimaraes 1-1 away with Vazte scoring right at the death, and then another 1-1 with Sevilla at the Reebok, this time with Bruno scoring.
Well, I mean, you look at those teams really now, and in a way, it's a pretty hard draw, actually, I think. So, Besiktas, Zenit and Sevilla in that group, when you consider... I mean, maybe they weren't all quite at the same level now as what they've gone on to be.
Intimidating places to go, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, Besiktas, I remember kind of... We went there on the day, on the kind of chartered plane, and, you know, there were so many warnings about be careful, and, you know, obviously the Galatasaray Leeds thing had happened probably about 5 or 6 years before that, where Leeds fans had been stabbed in the centre of Istanbul. So it seemed quite a dangerous place to go at this time. And, yeah, they definitely warned us other things not to do. And, you know, I think the stadium is actually only maybe 500 yards away from the central square. So I was back there a couple of weeks back, actually, and just walked down there myself. But actually, at the time, it was so dangerous that they wouldn't let us walk to the stadium, just 500 yards. They had to get us on a coach and into the away end that way, because they were worried about us getting attacked. I remember the atmosphere. I mean, that's pretty much one of the best atmospheres I've ever seen in terms of a Besiktas. And that was when it was, what, 20,000, maybe 20,000 crowd in a 35,000 stadium? So it was nowhere near.
Yeah.
But even with that, it was just so loud when you compare it to what it's like in England. And they did this thing before kick-off where they had a guy on the pitch kind of orchestrating the fans, so that by the time the players actually came out of the tunnel, they were all bouncing up and down and shouting, and it was so loud. And like I said, I remember speaking to, I think, Joey O'Brien playing that game. It might have been one of the very first games he played for Bolton.
I think he made his debut, from memory, if I'm right in thinking.
Yeah, it might well have been, yeah. And I remember speaking to him about it, and him saying, you know, how, you know, he looked around, and and it's quite a kind of baptism of fire, really, going into that atmosphere. But actually, you know, he played so well in that game, and that led to, you know, until his injury, is a good career for Bolton for him.
I think he played in the centre midfield, I believe, more of a holding role. He became synonymous with being a right back for a lot of his time at Bolton. Yeah, that was a fantastic debut. It must have been incredibly intimidating circumstances, because my ever experience of Turkish football was all the old late 90s watching United, for example, in Galatasaray and places like Welcome to Hell and all that carry on.
Yeah, it was certainly intimidating. Obviously, it didn't quite, get violent in that sort of way. But, you know, and then obviously we got a draw out there, which I don't think the Besiktas fans were expecting. So they didn't react very well to that for the game, because they were protesting. I think maybe the team hadn't been doing too well recently at the time anyway. So they were protesting, and there's all sorts of little fires being set in the stands. And then all the riot police marched out onto the pitch. Must have been, I don't know, maybe 100 riot police just marched out onto the pitch to try and quell the kind of anger and stuff. So again, in all those away games in Europe, they keep the Bolton fans in the stadium for about half an hour afterwards. So the theory was the home fans would go home, and then it'd be you know, nice and quiet for us and safe for us to leave. But that night, the Besiktas fans were not going home. So they were setting fire to the stadium. So again, you know, that was incredible, really, to experience that. I mean, there was probably about 500 Bolton fans there, and yeah, that again was for only our second trip, was quite an eye opener, really. And then, like you said, the Zenit game was you know, I mean, there's just no way that game would have happened had it not been a UEFA game, or at least it wouldn't have finished anyway. I mean, it might have started, but it certainly would have been abandoned had it been a Premier League match, because it was just the rain that was coming down and the water in the second half. I think I can remember one point where kind of Stelios kind of fell over and almost got completely submerged.
The slide tackles going out of the play and all sorts of things. It was unbelievable. I totally agree. Had they not travelled so far, would it been awkward to rearrange? I'm positive you're right. Would have been called off.
But in actual fact, it probably suited us quite a lot, because Zenit were a very good team. We were actually, you know, a good passing team, and I think that really kind of hampered their game that night. In fact, I think the only player who could cope with conditions was probably Arshavin, who was obviously pretty young at that point. But I remember him doing this kind of dribble through all the water and stuff, and nearly scoring this fantastic solo goal in the last minute. I think Yussi made a great save. But, you know, fortunately, we kind of got the goal early on, and what it became very difficult for them to get an equaliser as it became wetter and wetter.
Yeah, I know you're dead right. I mean, looking back through their team, I think the only ones that I really recognise is probably Hagen, Martin Skrtel, Kurzakov and Arshavin. So whilst they were obviously a good team in the league, there wasn't that many household names, I guess, in there at the time.
Maybe not. Yeah, I mean, some of those players did go on to do pretty well. I mean, you had Anyakov was playing right back, and Denisov in midfield, and those two, and Kurzakov and Arshavin were all key parts of the Zenit team that won the UEFA Cup, I think, 2 years later, and also the Russia team that got to the semi-finals of Euro 2008. Okay. So yeah, they were a handy team. I mean, some of them were still quite young, but they were definitely a handy team. So I think that was actually quite a big achievement to beat them.
Well, our team was interesting that night. We got Jaskalainen, O'Brien in defence this time, Ngoti, Ben Haim, Gardner, Faye, Stelios, Nakata, Speed, Nolan and Davies, with Okocha, Juve and Borghetti being the subs that came on. But yeah, an unbelievable night for many reasons. So we managed to get through, despite having, what, 3 draws out of 4. We managed to take those 6 points, which took us through to the last 32, where we faced Marseille. Now, I'll never forget the absolute injustice of that first leg. Yeah, we'd have denied at least one penalty, which to my mind at the time appeared to be absolutely nailed on.
Yeah, I think it was arguably 4 that night. So I think
could well have been. I think it was Abbiati in goal for Marseille. It included Frank Ribéry, who was again rumoured to be a Wanderers target at the time. Again, Chris, over to you. I mean, memories of either of those two games. I mean, it's again to see how close we were to progressing and to taking a famous old European team right the way to the wire was absolutely inspiring to see.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, again, you're probably looking at some players there, like the Zenit team, who were good young players who went on to achieve an awful lot. You got Ribéry and Nasri as well was in that team. I remember, in terms of the penalties, I think the main one I remember was, I think Barthez was playing in goal for Marseille and absolutely hauled down Kevin Davies. Mm-hmm. And how that wasn't a penalty, I'll never know. But yeah, it was a frustrating night, really, in that... I think we probably had the better of it. We just couldn't score. And then we obviously went over to Marseille, and that felt like a real proper big match. I mean, that was our first game in kind of the latter stage of the knockout. So, you know, the group stage games were big, but you always sort of knew that, well, you might have another game that you could, you know, if you lose this one, you can maybe get a win in the next one. Whereas that Marseille game was, you know, it was now or never for us, basically. And going to a massive famous stadium against a massive famous club, and it was really kind of, I really felt proud for, as a Bolton fan, to be able to do that, and it was just a shame that the game didn't quite work out for us. I mean, obviously Stelios scored when Barthez dropped a cross early on, and at that point, you know, again we had the away goal, Marseille needed two, thinking actually we could do this, we could beat someone, we'd go to Marseille and win. But I think we kind of, if we could just held out to half time, I think we would have won that.
Yeah, it was a killer, wasn't it? The goal in injury time.
They scored in the last 10 seconds, and I could sort of see it coming. I think Bruno Ngossi, you know, who was obviously a fantastic player for us, just misplaced a header, and it just set in motion an attack that you could sort of see that our players were a bit out of position. And I think it ended up with Stelios marking Ribéry on the back post from the cross, and obviously Stelios isn't the tallest. I mean, Ribéry hardly scores any headers in his entire career, but just scored the header just before half time, and at that point, that gave Marseille a lot of encouragement that, you know, they only did one goal at that point. Unfortunately, with Benaim's own goal, they got it. But yeah, I mean, I just remember there's obviously a lot of controversy at the time with how the Bolton fans were kept before the game and kept in this sort of dark warehouse for like half an hour before the match, because obviously how they treat fans over there wasn't very kind of advanced, shall we say, certainly not by English standards. And yeah, it was a strange place. I mean, you had all these big, huge perimeter fences that kind of block your view and stuff like that. So they've obviously updated that stadium a lot now, but it's although it was a famous stadium, it certainly felt a bit like an old stadium at that point, and not impressive in the kind of facilities sort of sense. Anyway,
not compared to its 2019 equivalent. Anyway, again, absolutely, I'm not entirely sure what the area around the ground is looking like these days, but the inside of it certainly had a facelift, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So that did it then for the first European Cup campaign in the 2004-2005 season. I realised as you were talking as well, Abbiati, I was getting the wrong season. That was a getting my ears mixed up.
No worries.
I just want to just check as well. Will, are you still there?
I am still there, yeah. No, I'm fascinated. I'm very much listening. It just seems like the sort of atmospheres which you just wouldn't expect in today's sort of world. And I'm fascinated to see that, and had I travelled to that, you know, I would have been absolutely frightened to death and put off us for life, which perhaps in hindsight might have been a good move. But I mean, my granddad travelled to both Bayern Munich and Atletico Madrid,
right, yeah.
So to know that's the sort of experience that fans were, you know, sort of drawn to, it's quite frightening, to be honest. But fascinating.
Well, I forgot to mention Guimarães as well, which is, again, that was like 4,000 fans going over to Portugal, and then Vazquez's equaliser in the last minute again was. That was another moment that was probably one of the best moments of my time, you know, watching Bolton, that this kid from Portugal had come on and scored this amazing goal with, you know, so many fans there. That was just such an amazing experience. I just remember the square in the centre of Guimarães with all these Bolton fans completely taking over the place, and it was such an amazing atmosphere. And to be honest, that was with 4,000 Bolton fans, and England are playing there against Holland in the Nations League, and there's going to be, you know, maybe, I don't know, well, at least 30,000 travelling fans, and maybe more in that one. So how that tiny place will cope with that many fans, I have no idea.
Oh, I'm sure they'll not make a noise equivalent to what the Wanderers fans did when that goal went in. Again, that was an unbelievably spectacular goal from a player that unfortunately never quite did it consistently enough, and suffered obviously with injuries too. But what a talent he could have been on his day. Well, okay, we're moving forward then. That was obviously our Wanderers' first taste of European football. The following season, and Will, I bring you into this.
Yep.
We were talking before about, you know, this is how it used to be. I mean, I was in the car today with my kids, and we were talking about football. And daughter's like, "Oh, why do you support Bolton? The rubbish." I was like, well, haven't always been rubbish. You know, it's not that long ago that we were one of the top sort of six or seven teams in the Premier League for a consistent 4 or 5 year basis. And this is what I'm moving on to. My very sort of latest point. was that the following season, Wanderers were hoping to get into the Champions League, because if you remember it well, that at Christmas time, December 2006,
yes,
we'd won five on the bounce, and we were third in the Premier League. So what, half a season away from qualifying for the competition?
Oh yeah.
I'm wondering if you have any particular memories yourself of that season, or of what was to come after.
Yeah, I mean, obviously being fairly young in the grand scheme of things, you know, that sort of a season was about as good as it got for me. Seen as at that point compared to how we are now, it was quite a spectacle. I don't particularly have any specific memories from that season, although it just, you know, I've read Sam's book quite a couple of times, and the whole story behind that about how he was quite prepared to go into Champions League football, and then Galatasaray sort of claiming that the club wasn't ready for it and that we weren't going to go ahead with it. To make that decision for a football club, as much as you can challenge it, you know, that there's obviously more to it, and I'm sure they knew the full story in regard to it, and I'm sure Chris, you could shed some light on it. It was one of those seasons which could have changed the future of our club forever, really, and it turned out to perhaps be the worst thing we ever did.
Yeah, I mean, I think looking back, it still seems like a pretty great season to me.
Yeah, no, of course.
Just quite for Europe altogether, but yeah, and obviously we... You know, at the halfway stage, you know, you're looking at it and thinking, well, maybe we can qualify for the Champions League. And I just remember, I mean, that season was when we were in the front three of Davis on the right and Elker and Diouf, and I think that has to be the best front three that Bolton have had in my lifetime.
Absolutely,
three incredible players, and obviously Elker was sensational for us, and you know, did a fantastic job and really kind of took us to that next level, I think. So yeah, it was a shame how it tailed away. I mean, I think it probably was inevitable that we wouldn't quite keep up the pace we kept in that first half of the season. I mean, we have to be realistic about, you know, what resources the clubs we were up against were, and obviously they could spend big in January, and obviously it turned out that unfortunately we couldn't that year, which, like you say, it turned out to be the point where Allardyce kind of sort of made his decision privately at that point that he was going to move on. And obviously, then it came out towards the end of the season. It was a sad time that he left, and worrying, really, because as much as, you know, Sammy Lee had worked at the club and it was liked by everyone, you know, I don't think anyone could have replaced Sam Allardyce at that point, really.
Yeah, it was a shocking departure, wasn't it? But I think he did right. There's certain moments in that season that I'd forgotten about, and reading back of them. I mean, I remember the Newcastle away victory. Being right up in the sort of second to last row there, and not really knowing who'd scored the winner until we're on the bus going home. What else did we have that season? We beat Rovers away 1-0 again, which was the week after the Newcastle victory. The famous Ivan Campo header with what felt like about 12,000 Wanderers fans in it.
Oh, that was nice.
It was a hell of a season. It just makes you wonder, I guess, Chris, to come to you on this one, what might have been had Allardyce had that extra bit of money. Obviously, there was talk at the time as well about certain players leaving. I know in the book you mentioned about Anelka to United, which came about the following season. But I think that's probably connected to some of the disappointment of Allardyce leaving, because I guess he would have played a big part in signing Anelka in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no doubt that once Allardyce left and things, obviously the season afterwards started pretty badly, pretty quickly, that Anelka was obviously going to look around at that point and think, well, you know, I'm a better player than a Premier League relegation battle, and you know, you'd be absolutely right to think that, really. And yeah, I think United had an agree, or from speaking to a member of staff at the time, that they and Elka told that member of staff that he'd agreed to sign for Manchester United, and it was only a few days later that Chelsea came in and got the deal done. But yeah, I mean, the funny thing, I guess, was that actually at the start of that season, in the Sammy Lee season, that actually Anelka signed a new contract.
I remember it well.
Yeah, but I wonder now whether that was basically, you know, you sign a new contract and help us out with the fee, but we'll let you go in January. I think that's probably what happened then.
Yeah, I think it makes sense, doesn't it, given the timing and the circumstances, because I fully agree, whilst he was playing below himself, I'm sure he certainly benefited from an extra few quid a week to stick with us for another 6 months, which worked out well for everybody. Okie dokie, so moving forward, at the end of that season, obviously Allardyce left the 2-2 draw away to Chelsea at Stamford Bridge. Wanderers maintained the qualification for Europe despite a fairly poor end to the season, and all the rumours that surrounded Allardyce caused things to go fairly tits up. Okay, so in the next season, obviously Wanderers qualified for Europe again. Sammy Lee lasts until October when he's replaced by Megson. Lee took charge of the first game, Chris, as you mentioned before, against Rabotnički of Macedonia. A late Abdoulaye goal, I seem to recall. They're 1-1 draw away.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, that could have gone very wrong that night because Bolton played very badly that night against a team that really should have been beaten. But it was the sort of a point where they were playing badly in the league. I think they'd lost 5 of the first 6 games in the Premier League. So there was just no confidence in the team at all. And yeah, they went 1-0 down, and I think that Robert Nish had a chance to go 2-0 up, which they probably should have taken. So I think everyone that was there that night was starting to get very worried that, you know, we were on for a pretty humiliating defeat there. But yeah, then an Elker had a free kick that the keeper made a mess of, and thankfully Mate was there to kind of get a draw out of it. I mean, a draw at Rabotnički wasn't amazing by any means, but it was in terms of getting us through, you know, it helped us and was enough.
It was invaluable. How did you get to Macedonia? Was it an interesting trip?
Yeah, I mean, I attended for quite a few of those early ones. I tended to go because they did an official travel where they...
Yeah, basically you'd, in and out kind of thing.
Yeah, so you'd go to the Manchester airport for like 5 a.m. on the Thursday morning. You'd get an official club charter flight straight to the city, have like 4 or 5 hours in the city, go to the match, and then you'd go straight back to the airport and straight back to Manchester. So it's like more or less a 23-24 hour round trip, which was always a bit knackering, but particularly when you had, I think I went to work the day after as well, which is probably a bit of a mistake. But I was at work on the Wednesday. I would nip to Macedonia for a day on the Thursday, and then go straight back at work on Friday. Yeah. But no, it was a fantastic experience. And again, it was obviously a very kind of poor place in terms of, you know, economics of the place, but you know, people were very, very welcoming. And it was interesting to see a country that you know it's very unlikely you'd choose to go to on holiday. And it was just interesting to see what it was like. And like I said, people were very welcoming.
Oh, it sounds like a fascinating place. There's a couple of those away trips to come as well. We'll discuss more about the sort of deprivation that you see, which is interesting to when you live in a town next door to Wigan. But the group stages saw us drawn against Braga, against Aris Thessaloniki, and Red Star Belgrade, and then of course Bayern Munich. Again, Wanderers took a sort of fairly kind of prosaic approach to those games with 3 draws and 1 victory. So Braga was 1-1 against at home with Juve scoring. Aris again 1-1 with Stelios scoring a very, very late equaliser against his countrymen. The famous away win against Red Star in Belgrade through Gavin McCann. And then of course the Bayern Munich game, which I suspect we both might have something to say about. But perhaps if you could just give us your thoughts on those 4, if you don't mind, Chris.
Yeah, well, like you say, it's funny that kind of we had the same record in both groups, so 3 draws and a win. And actually, we only ever lost 2 games in Europe. The two nights we went out in Marseille and in Sporting Lisbon. But yeah, I mean, I seem to remember the Braga game being quite disappointed with the crowd. To be honest, I think it was quite a low crowd. And obviously, you know, I understand that the team was struggling in the Premier League at that point, so maybe enthusiasm wasn't quite as much as it could have been.
Just slightly under 11,000, according to official records.
So I found that a bit strange, really. That you know, Europe was sort of the thing I've been looking forward to for years, and it seemed like the pinnacle for Bolton as high as it was going to get, and a lot of people weren't there. But yeah, that was just, I mean, you're going to get that in cup competition sometimes, and I think we made a bit of a meal of that match really in the end, in that we only drew 1-1. I think they got a quite late equaliser, and that seemed a bit of a worrying result at the time, but. Obviously, that then led to Bayern Munich, which, you know, was, you don't need to tell me, you don't need me to tell you, was one of the most amazing games that you know, any Bolton fan's ever going to experience. Really, it was just to go to a club like that with such a history, to go to a stadium like that, which is, you know, undoubtedly one of the best stadiums in the world, to take so many fans, and to play as well as we did. I mean, considering the team we had out as well, I mean, you look at the team they had that night and the team we fielded, you think, how did we get a draw with that team?
An unbelievable mismatch. And if I may just read out the team. So we had Al-Habzi in goal, Andy O'Brien, Sid, Mikulic, Ricardo Gardner, Michael Alonso, Nolan, Guthrie, McCann, Bratton and Super Kev up front. Their team, by comparison, Oliver Kahn, Marcel Janssen, Lucio, Van Buyten, Lel, Ribery, Ottel, Van Bommel, Schweinsteiger, Podolski, and Klose. Not to mention Zé Roberto, who didn't get off the bench as opposed to Zoltán Harsanyi on our bench.
Tony Kroos and Luca Toni on the bench as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Toni and Kroos both came on as sub. So according to the official record, 4,000 away fans in and among 66, as opposed to the official count in the Braga game with 31 away fans. So a bit of a difference between the two there. And I just remember there being a phenomenal day. I did the day trip there as well, in and out on that one. I've never been to Germany before. The game itself is a bit of a haze, but what an experience. Just going to the city itself, absolutely phenomenal experience, and one that I'll never forget. And I still pop out the old DVDs every now and then. The club had a bit of a spell of releasing the more memorable games on DVD straight after. So those will be treasured forever, I think, as long as they don't deteriorate and disappear. But what an absolutely unbelievable place, an unbelievable team we faced. And I remember just being over the moon that we even scored. And obviously we did score earlier on the Garden after 8 minutes. And yeah. the famous Davies equaliser on 82, Chris.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've got to admit, that obviously the Davies goal was phenomenal. Actually, the Gardner one was meant even more to me, because it was so unexpected that we'd take the lead by a minute. Obviously, we went there, we weren't playing well in the Premier League. And, I think I remember Gary Megson saying to me that he feared we could get absolutely battered in that match, particularly with the team we had out. So just the fact that we took the lead at the Allianz Arena against Bayern Munich was, I don't know, and obviously it was right down our end as well. It was just such an unbelievable feeling. To be honest, I think where we really made an impact in that game was the first 15 seconds. Because I think Bayern kicked off, they played it back to, I think it was Van Buyten maybe, and Kevin Davies just went straight through him. And from that moment, you could sense Bayern thinking, not sure about this. They're not going to just let us pass around them and win easily here. And from that moment, I think we had them in terms of giving them a real game. Ribéry was sensational that night, but I think a lot of the others, we got to them. And Kevin Davies did that a few times in Europe. I think he did it in the home game against Atletico Madrid as well. I think he did something similar. He went straight through one of the defenders in the first 10 seconds. And it's amazing what difference that can make in terms of the whole of their team looking around thinking, not sure I fancy
it. Yeah, it's certainly a good way to introduce yourself on that sort of stage, isn't it? The nice early reducer. I seem to remember his ongoing battles with Lucio that night. He was no shrinking violet at all, but I certainly don't think he'd ever faced that kind of physicality in the Bundesliga or anywhere else at the start of his career. Christ, I mean, November 2007, I remember as much as I can recall, like it was yesterday. God, it just seems like a million years ago compared to what we have to put up with these days.
It's scary that it's 12 years ago, isn't it, really?
yeah, frightening. It was only 3 weeks after that, though, that we faced Aris Thessaloniki at home again, another poor crowd. We had 10,800 against Braga, 10,200 this time. However, compare that with 31 away fans from Braga to nearly 100 times that, with 2,300 coming from Greece. I just remember the atmosphere that night, being almost in stunned silence in the Bolton end, watching the theatricality of the Greek supporters with the flares, with the banners, with the synchronicity of the movement. I mean, the game itself, I remember being a bit of a washout again, with Stelios scoring very, very late on. Mm. But what an experience just to see the home stadium rocking in that fashion.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, though, they were amazing as a travelling fans. And I think I remember at the end, kind of maybe both sets of fans kind of applauding each other because we were just so impressed by their fans and how much noise they make. And I think Greek fans are particularly good for that. I mean, I think we played Aris away in a pre-season friendly. I think it must have been the season that summer afterwards. Probably kind of built, you know, from that game, the friendship was built on that night. And that was a friendly. And again, the atmosphere at Aris's ground was just sensational for a friendly. So it's like, I went out to another game in Greece quite recently to PAOK in the same city. And again, it just seems the Greek fans, the atmosphere they make is just brilliant. And I agree with you. I was so impressed by their fans that night. And, you know, really, they should have won. They were 1-0 up. I think one of their players nearly scored from the halfway line with about 5 minutes left. That would have made it 2-0. Jussi made a great save again, and then Stelios kind of got the goal, which obviously rescued us, because I think pretty much had we lost that game, that was it. We were out.
Yeah, and the games came thick and fast as well. These were all within about a 6-week period. We started off in October against Braga, and we finished in the first week of December away to Red Star. I didn't go to that one, but my uncle did, and his tales of being locked in that famous hotel all day, being visited by the chairman and being bought a pint for his troubles and all this kind of thing, and coming home with pockets full of money from the city as well, that he wasn't able to exchange in advance, but wasn't able to change back because no one would do it. A Gavin McCann goal, again, made famous by the imagery of that game. But what was the stadium like there? I mean, that's always somewhere I'd love to have visited. 45,000 on that day, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly wasn't full. But it's probably like Besiktas, in that even though it wasn't full, it was still pretty loud for large parts of it. And the main thing I remember is just, we got a taxi down to the ground, and we were very worried about, you know, what was going to happen, because I don't know if you remember, but I think about 3 days before that they'd had a match in the league at home, and there'd been some violence, and a plainclothes police officer got involved, and one of the Red Star fans had actually put a lit flare down his throat, which is scary. So we'd read that in the news and thought, blimey, what on earth are we going into here? And just getting the taxi down to the stadium and seeing so, you know, rows and rows of riot police with guns, and it must have been at least 1,000 there, because they were worried that if anything had happened that night, Red Star would have got kicked out of Europe. And just, I've never seen so many riot police in one place, and thinking, what on earth is this? And then we said to the taxi driver, please drop us outside the away end. And what did he do? He dropped us outside the home end. So we then had to walk around the stadium, kind of like not speaking any English in case anyone found out who we are, just in case. I mean, it probably would have been all right, but I just didn't want to speak any English and take the chance of people figuring out who we are and attacking us or something.
Certainly a scary place. I mean, the team that night was, again, another interesting one, given the woes that we had in the league at the time. We had Al Habsi, Hunt, Mate, Mikulic, J. Lloyd Samuel, Stelios, Speed, Andronic, Timorian, Wilhelmsen, McCann, and Daniel Bratton, with a late appearance from James Sinclair. Not so many familiar names in their team. I mean, Coraman was there, obviously played for Real Madrid for a time. But just to see Wanderers in that kind of atmosphere, that kind of stadium, must have been something that you can look back on now and think, Christ, is it really that long ago?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. It's a famous stadium. Obviously, Red Star had won the European Cup kind of early 90s, so it's certainly a famous name. And for us to go there, I mean, until last year, I think Arsenal won there last year, but until then, we were the only British team ever to win at Red Star Belgrade, when you consider the amount of teams that have been there. That was a hell of an achievement. I mean, it has to be said that the Red Star team we played was not very good at all. Even with our reserve team out, we were better.
Well, they lost every single game in that group campaign. I mean, we only won one out of four, but we still ended up with 6 points. They were four losses from four. So yeah, clearly no great shakes.
No, but you know, that still shouldn't take away, you know, what, you know, the fact that, you know,
not at all.
A club like us to go to Red Star Belgrade and win, you know, we should always kind of be proud of that. And you know, it was a fantastic night. And I just remember, I think Elias Diouf wasn't actually playing. I think they'd rested him. And I remember him, because with Diouf, he was always, even if he hadn't done anything in a match, when we'd won away, he would always make sure he was the last over to the away fans to milk the applause. Even when other players, maybe someone else got two or three goals or something, he'd always make sure he was the last to milk the applause. And he wasn't even in the squad that night. And I just remember after the game, you know, obviously we clapped the players and we're celebrating. And then Diouf came over and basically got a bigger applause than everyone else, and he hadn't even played.
I seem to remember him doing that I think it was for Blackburn when he came to back to play at the Reebok one, so it might have been Sunderland, I can't recall.
Maybe so.
And he did exactly the same.
He knows how to milk the support, you've got to give him that. But yeah, I think we loved him for that. But yeah, that was particularly funny when on a night that he hadn't even played at all.
Well, he certainly played in the next round on the 14th of Feb, Valentine's night. I remember taking my girlfriend at the time to Valentine's night. Well, here you go. Yeah, darling, it's a nice trip to watch Wanderers against Atletico Madrid. And Diouf did turn up that night, scoring the winning goal with 15 or 16 minutes left in front of 26,000. A game notable as well for Aguero's little temper tantrum in the direction of Matt Taylor.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember kind of when we drew Atletico, thinking, you know, I'd seen a little bit of Aguero playing for them, and I'm thinking, this guy, I mean, I think he was maybe 18, 19 at the time, thinking, this guy is amazing.
Not too old.
Yeah, but even then you could sort of tell this guy is going to be really special. So I was kind of looking forward to seeing him play. So it was strange, really, in that I was a little bit disappointed because he was a sub that night. And, and so I was a bit disappointed at first that I wasn't going to see him play. And then they brought him on. And actually, I think before he came on after about an hour, and until that point, we were absolutely battering them. We should have been about 4-0 up, and we just couldn't score again like Marseille at home. Right. I think their keeper made a couple of great saves, and we missed a couple of chances. But then, as soon as they brought him on, he was so much better than the rest of their team, and they took over the game completely. I think they nearly scored, and then he was actually only on the pitch 14 minutes. But even that 14 minutes, I was thinking this guy's good. But then, obviously, the incident with Taylor happened, where he kind of spat in the direction of Taylor. I mean, I think he kind of claimed that it wasn't actually aimed at Taylor; it was at the floor. But I guess we'll never know. Really, it's one person's word against the other, and
it certainly
helped us. We'll take the red card, because I think he was sent off, and then maybe about 40 seconds later, we went up the other end of the pitch and scored, and it was just a kind of wave of momentum. And that again, a full house against Atletico Madrid, and to beat them, because we played Marseille at home, couldn't get that goal, and that cost us the 2 years before that. So we knew we needed to win, and to get a 1-0 win at home in Europe is, with the away goals rule, is a really good result. So that was a fantastic night to beat a team like that and give ourselves a real chance of getting through.
They had some cracking players too. Yeah, Aguero came on for Reyes, formerly of Arsenal. Maxi Rodriguez, who'd go on to play for Liverpool. Portuguese winger Simão as well. He made tons of appearances for the national team. And Diego Forlan as well, so absolutely no mugs whatsoever. Again, it was with excitement, I suppose, just a week later that we all made that trip to Madrid. I remember going there and spending a fantastic day in a city, again, I'd never been to before, and that absolutely magnificent stadium, the Vicente Calderon, proper old-fashioned concrete ball, mismatched stands with different shapes and sizes. 30,000 that night, so again, not a full house, but decent 3,000 away following. Obviously, we know some ugly scenes that came about at the end of the game. I remember being on a flight home with a guy whose head had been split open in front of me, and his Wanderers shirt had been dyed pink because of the amount of blood that had fallen. But Wanderers won. They won overall, I should say. 0-0 performance. Absolutely stoic in terms of defence. Again, a decent team out. Not first choice, I'd say, man for man. But Yossi, Hunt, Andy O'Brien, Gary Cahill, obviously signed that year from Aston Villa. J. Lloyd, Samuel, Stelios, McCann, Nolan, Joey O'Brien, Matt Taylor and Kevin Davies. So subs being Juve, Campo and Matey. Again, Chris, a resolute performance from Wanderers, certainly not spectacular, but I do recall us having one or two chances that we might have done better at. It was quite an intimidating Atletico Madrid team. Again, without Aguero being there, but Reyes, Forlan and Luis Garcia being three particularly dangerous opponents.
Yeah, and I guess the irony is that, looking, 11 years on, that we did an Atletico Madrid on Atletico Madrid, didn't we? Really, that's what they've been doing to everyone else ever since then. But we basically shut them down. That, I mean, I'm sure if you're a neutral, that would have been one of the worst games you've ever seen, because there were not a lot of chances that match at all. But for us, that didn't matter at all. We just needed a 0-0 draw out of it, and I think the 4,000 Bolton fans that were there were perfectly happy to watch a 0-0 to get us through. And I think Stelios maybe had a bit of a chance, but I think maybe Luis Garcia probably missed their best chance, maybe from quite close in. But apart from that, they didn't create much at all. We defended so well that night, and again, obviously at the time Atletico Madrid hadn't done much in Europe for a while, but you look back now at what they've done in 11 years since then, and you think, well, we went there and won, or at least won an aggregate, and the amount of other British and good top quality European sides that have gone out to them in Europe since then, it's just made, as the years have gone on, it's made it look a bigger and bigger achievement, really.
Yeah, it's absolutely magnificent. And what struck me looking back through all this was the short time frame that what we had going on in the league as well, which we'll talk about in a minute. But it was only, 10 or 12 days later, a fortnight, on the 6th of March, that we entertained Sporting at home. Again, a decent crowd, just a shade under 26,000 on as we took the lead against Sporting Lisbon, with Gabby McCann scoring the goal. Now, Simon Vucevic, an absolute favourite of mine from Football Manager 2007, cracking left winger, about 500k. He scored the equaliser with 20 minutes to go, which hampered our chances of progress. But again, it was another game against a storied opponent in European football, where we probably should have done better. I mean, again, the team was up and down because of the league fall at the time. players we've not mentioned before, like Helgeson. I mean, Campo in there as well. Campo, who obviously he was there for such a majority of our time in European football, but never really didn't make too many appearances in the competition for various reasons. But again, some decent players in their side as well. I mean, Veloso. I wonder if you could perhaps touch on him for a minute or two. He was seemingly forever linked with Wanderers at that time.
Well, wasn't Veloso the one that that Megson said we wouldn't sign because it'd be like putting a tiara on a Shire horse? I think that was a famous quote. Well, yeah, I mean, no, he was certainly. I remember him being a top player that night, and then the 2 years after that, where every transfer window, we think is this going to be the one where he finally signs, and then it never did. I think we might have missed our moment on that one. Now I think he might not be too keen on coming here anymore. But
I'm not too sure.
But yeah, I mean, like you say, we were definitely a better team that night. We should have been at least 2-0 up, maybe 3-0 up before they equalised, and you could just sense when they equalised the kind of the air kind of going out of enthusiasm, but just it swung the momentum so much then getting that away goal. There's such a huge difference between 1-0 at home and 1-1 because of that away goals rule. We knew we'd have to go there and score. So yeah, I think that was the moment where, sadly, that with what turned out in the Uela game, that Vucevic goal was the beginning of the end. Sadly,
It was. And interestingly, you can still go on the BBC Sport website and vote on your man of the match from that night, which is interesting.
Right. Okay.
only 10 years later. So it was again a week or so after that that we all traipsed over to Lisbon, and again, what an absolutely unbelievable city. Very similar to Guimaraes, I should think, in respect to spending most of the day in that big town square with the great big fountain and with the odd trip out to find an off licence that still had some bottles of Superbock that you would leave in the sun all day and still sup. But again, a sort of changed Wanderers side because the league commitments that night meant, unfortunately, the boys came up short, losing 1-0 away. A proud loss. I mean, I still thought we played quite well that night, but obviously the focus was elsewhere, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad, really, when you look back at that game and you think, well, that was the last 16 of the UEFA Cup. You could argue it's certainly in terms of Europe, anyway, it's the furthest we've ever got. And it's probably one of the most high-profile games in Bolton's history because of that. Yeah. And it's still, I mean, it seemed crazy to me at the time, and it seems even more crazy to me now that we did what we did in terms of picking the team that we picked that night.
Just to give the listeners an idea, sorry for me interrupting. Yeah. Al Habsi, Hunt, Cahill, Mate and Samuel, so nothing too outrageous there. But as you move into midfield, you see Joey O'Brien, Danny Guthrie, Andronic, Stelios, Vaz Tay and Heide Helgeson with Daniel Bratton and Nathan Wolfe. I think it's Nathan Wolfe, I think I'm right. Who came on as substitutes in the last 20 minutes to try and earn us a point, try and get that important away goal to put the advantage back in our favour. So no Juve, no Campo, Davies, Nolan, Speed. But God, Yaskalain obviously was out injured at the time. But to think of what might have been, because that was a season obviously that Rangers got in the final against Zenit in Manchester, and came up short with that in that famous final. But yeah, God, what might have been, eh?
Yeah, and Rangers beat. I think Rangers beat Sporting the next round.
They did. So, that's yeah, right.
I think we may well have been better than Rangers at that time, and certainly considering we didn't lose by much even with the reserve team. I think we could have won that game against Sporting, and I know from speaking to players that were left behind, people like Kevin Davies, how gutted they were about that. They weren't glad of the rest by any means. They wanted to play in that match, and obviously that then carried over to them losing at Wigan on the Sunday as well because players were really down about it. So yeah, it frustrates me really that was the way it ended. Particularly when I think we knew at the time because Bolton were in a relegation battle that the chances of us getting Europe again anytime soon were remote. And obviously it could be years and years before we get in Europe again if ever. So the fact that we went out in that manner, when we went out at Marseille, we'd given it a real go, we'd done our best, and we hadn't quite made it, and you could live with that. I think the Sporting, the players who played that night, like you say, did their best. They actually did. To play pretty well, but it's just frustrating when you list those players that didn't play that night and were perfectly fit to play, that we're always going to wonder what might have been, and I think that's a real shame.
Yeah, I remember going to the Wigan away game that fell immediately after, which was obviously deemed to be the priority by Megson. The fact that we lost that sparked scenes of almost unbridled anger in a lot of sunburned and still hungover Wanderers fans. We were so so disappointed, and I don't think I've ever met anyone, any Bolton fan, that's ever felt like that decision that he made was justifiable in any regard. Because although, you know, stability in football is obviously important, we're all here for success. We're not here to just merely to survive. You know, we'd all go and support someone like Middlesbrough if that's all we're interested in. The chance of glory that we passed up was the ultimate slap in the face, and certainly something that I've never really managed to come to grips with. Because it's one of those things, isn't it? You know, obviously, yeah, Premier League, yeah, fine. You know, you may go, maybe down, you may end up back there one day. But the last 16 of a UEFA Cup competition, a strong UEFA Cup competition that we had, our full strength team would, in my opinion, have a decent chance of doing well in, was unforgivable.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I guess we weren't the only club to do things like that. I mean,
no, not at all.
Villa did it and stuff, but yeah, when any club does it, I don't agree with it, and certainly when my own club does it, I definitely don't agree with it, because you know, you spend all season in the Premier League trying to qualify for Europe. For us to qualify for Europe twice was a huge achievement for Bolton Wanderers, and then to actually, you know, having toiled for 12 months to get into it, then not to really bother with it when you're there and actually doing pretty well in it, just made no sense to me whatsoever.
Yeah, there was a big argument at the time. I remember it was Martin O'Neill, I think, was in charge of Aston Villa, and there was again the same argument was put to him, and I seem to remember there being sort of ramifications for him and for his decision making as well, as to why he would fight so hard to get in and then fight so hard to get out.
I mean, I can understand the finances of it, and undoubtedly there's more finances for staying in the Premier League than you know, even winning the UEFA Cup. But it comes down to what is football all about? What are we trying to do? I mean, and what we're trying to do surely is to win things and to do as well as you can as a club. And once you get to a point like that and say, well, we're not bothered, then I don't understand what the purpose of the club is, which is a crazy thing to say.
Will, do you have any disagreements or any sort of advancements upon that? It seems crazy, doesn't it, that you'd pass up that chance of success and immortality for the sake of a little bit of stability.
I was going to say, for the sake of, you know, securing something like that on national grounds, domestic level, is too much of a sacrifice, in my opinion, for what could have been on the European stage. The potential that the club had, I think, on that particular level was something else. Obviously, we proved we had the ability to do it. Perhaps the reason that didn't happen was because, you know, like you said, Megson left those players out for that last leg, and it is literally just a case of what could have been had those players travelled, got in the squad, you know, and made a difference on the night. And again, you know, like I said earlier, you look in hindsight and you think, what else could the club have been had that been a difference that night? And you know, all right, Wigan's a relatively important game now in the scheme of things, but 10 years ago it wasn't by any means. And I don't know anyone daft enough to have chosen that over the potential, you know, chance for another European success.
Definitely not. And I guess it's gone to show, hasn't it, that ultimately it was all a bit pointless because a relegation did take place, although obviously at a later time. And all you have to look back upon is what might have been, not only this, but also the FA Cup semi-final under Owen Coyle, which could have gone a very different way. And who knows whether that sort of sliding doors moment might have been... taken us further on than where we ended up being.
Yeah, it's continually debated, you know, where the downfall actually started. You know, a lot of people believe it was the Stoke semi-final. But then you look at it from further back and then you think, well, actually, was that choice to sort of bow out of Europe almost voluntarily actually the start of it all? It's one which you could definitely question even now, so...
Yeah, no, there's an argument for it. So, Chris, to move forward into sort of present times, I know obviously we've got your journalist hat on, but also with your supporters hat on. How have you viewed the last couple of years? We'll call it the Ken Anderson era. from top to bottom, if you could just give us your opinion on what's going on, what's gone wrong, what may go right, and then we'll see where we are.
Well, I mean, it's been a... I think for the first couple of years, it's strangely in that I think there was always a sense that things could go wrong at any moment. There was never really a sense, you know, ever since Ken Anderson came in, that everything was all under control. But at the same time, the one thing he did do right was choose the right manager. And that is the single most important decision any chairman will ever make, is choosing the right manager. For 2 years, certainly, Phil Parkinson did an unbelievable job for the club. And the season in League One, although, you know, we all felt that Bolton Wanderers should not be in League One, you know, it was a fantastic season in terms of the experience of it and how dramatic, we got promoted. And the last season obviously was difficult, but, it did give us that Nottingham Forest game at the end of last season, which was, again, one of the most special days following Bolton Wanderers. In terms of last season, I was perfectly happy just to stay up. Obviously, I know a lot of fans had concerns even then about the style of play. I was okay with that in terms of just stay up that season, then consolidate this season. And to me, it's gone wrong this season, really, in terms of it should have been a case of, obviously the plan was to increase the quality of the squad. That looked promising, obviously, for the first month or so. But I think, we've looked back since then and players that have left, like Moraes and Lafondre and such like, and we just haven't replaced them. And I think, unfortunately, things have gone wrong on the signings that were made in the summer. Now, all of them have done their best. I don't for one minute question the effort of any of those players. But the quality just isn't there. And it's been sad to see it all season, really, as things have unfortunately got worse and worse. And to go to games now and almost know that you're not going to score a goal and you're going to lose the game, it's just so hard. And it's as bad if you were losing 5-2 and stuff, that would every week that would be bad. But it's to me it's the sort of worst that you're not even going to score and have that enjoyment of at least having a goal to celebrate.
Yeah, it's not very competitive, is it?
Yeah, so it's just become more weary as the season's gone on. As it's probably been, I'm trying to think, it's been a less enjoyable season at my time as Sporting Bolton. I don't think that has been really.
No, Will, your thoughts on that? I know we speak regularly on the topic, but
yeah,
it's certainly even the weeks off where you kind of forget how bad we are.
Yeah,
still kind of get things like this reminding you. Well, actually, yeah, we are rubbish. So
yeah, it's not the most.
It's never ending.
It's not the most pleasant reminders to have on a weekly basis, almost a weekend like this where you've got the weekend off and you actually have time to think and you're just like, yeah, it's actually all right when we're not losing every week. So it's just depressing, like Chris said, to go into pretty much every game of every week, and think, well, we're almost consigned to losing here and not really having a chance of getting out of such a rhythm is pretty depressing.
No, I totally agree. So to the future then, Chris, obviously there's been a lot of talk about what's been going on behind the scenes. I know we've joked a little bit about a tweet that one of your colleagues at the magazine put out. I wonder if you could perhaps elaborate that and give us the full truth, completely betraying any trust or any sort of promises you're giving to your friends.
Yeah. I should say first of all, it's not a story that I was personally involved with. It's very much one that came from his contacts. So he's got more information on it than myself. From what I understand, there was a party that were interested middle of last week that looked promising, but I've heard since then that might have come and gone within 24 hours, really. So that, but I should stress that I don't think that's the party that Mark Isles and Alan Nixon are writing about now. So as far, I'm reading it as much as the same as you are now in terms of following Mark's work. Mark's done a fantastic job in terms of covering the club for the Bolton News, and so I'm reading his stories like anyone else at the moment. So although this other party that were interested might have gone away now, middle of last week, from reading Mark's stories, it sounds like hopefully there is still another party that is still there. And I'm just hoping, like you, that comes through and something happens.
Fingers crossed, Will. Obviously, the latest is that we don't really know what's what, apart from the fact we've got an impending deadline to pay, or for the prospective new owners, I should say, to pay, to guarantee that we avoid that points deduction. What do you think is going to happen? Do you have any gut feeling or anything like that?
Yeah, I said on Wednesday, I think the few days that we've got until sort of this time, well, this weekend, where it was a bit of breathing space for everyone to sit back and think, look, we've survived it, but we've got to look to regroup and make a plan for either way for whatever's going to happen next time round. Obviously, we're looking into next week and you're thinking, right, well, we've got a deadline and a potential choice to voluntarily dip into admin. We've also got till Friday, I think that is, to enter into that. And if not, obviously, then we need a plan for what's going to happen. If not, because come Tuesday, we'll be 7 days from being back in the courtroom, whatever it is, Wednesday rather. And then, you know, we'll have to start making plans for that, if that's going to be the more likely outcome as we get closer to that. And then me and Ian were obviously there on Wednesday, and we sort of looked at it as a sort of you either pay up or else scenario. So I'm just hoping that it really doesn't get to that. And either way, whether we voluntarily dip into admin or a deal's done, I'm hoping that either way that's done, because it didn't sound particularly promising if it's not.
Well, it's funny because we're actually sneaking ever closer, and it seems to be lost in the news a little bit, that we're moving ever closer to the end of the season as well. I mean, there's only, I don't even know how many games there's left. It feels like we've only got next month really to play out. Obviously, we play QPR on Saturday, on the 30th, and then we've got feels like about 400 games in April before the season finishes away at Nottingham Forest on the 5th of May. So I guess if we don't take this payment made in the next week, there's every possibility that with a points deduction, assuming it is 12 as it appears to have been to other clubs in a similar situation, that defeat on the 30th against QPR could mean relegation being confirmed.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the admin option, that's obviously the 12 point option. You're thinking, well, perhaps, you know, that's the obvious answer, given that, you know, our season's already over. You know, I think that the chances of a last ditch survival hope have absolutely been shattered. I think that was the case, you know, following the Wigan game. So we can sort of just admit defeat at this point and just go, you know, look, we may as well take this option rather than allowing it to run over into next season, because that's the last thing we want, given that, you know, League One's a scrappy division as it is, and to have that added on top of things obviously isn't going to help by any means. So, I mean, you asked before, you know, what's my hunch on the outcome, and I'm hoping that that's the route it's going to end up going down, because it looks like nobody's going to really want to buy us. So admin seems like the only relatively sensible option, given that otherwise it's pretty certain liquidation. I hope it isn't, but it does look like that.
It's also an option that's befallen with it. It's got a lot of perilous moments along the way. It's not
it's an expensive option, isn't it?
A cheap process,
yeah,
most definitely. Chris, then to sort of bring things to a close, do you think that we can manage to sort of bring about another Forest scenario, another miraculous last minute survival case, or do you think it's more of a question of us dusting ourselves down, maybe giving some experience to some talented youngsters we've got coming through and making the best of it ahead of a promotion fight, hopefully in League One next season?
I mean, I think it's going to be very difficult now to see any repeat of last season in terms of staying up. But I mean, I think even without this situation going on, it'd be hard to see us staying up, you know, given the point situation now and just the form that the players are in. Unfortunately, I think for this season, I'd love to be proved wrong, but I can't see us staying up this season. It's just a case of somehow getting a takeover done, avoiding a points deduction, and just praying that we can attack League One like we attacked it last time and you know, and get out of it. Because there's no doubt, if you go in League One and you're only there for 1 year and you get promoted, it's actually quite fun. But if you get stuck there and things start going even worse financially, then, you know, we've seen what happened to Portsmouth and clubs like that, and we don't want to keep dropping further.
No, we've said before on the podcast many times, you know, let's not forget that there were times in League One where it was great fun. There were also times in League One where it was a bumming slog as well at the same time. So that it's not all golden everything. But we'll see what happens. I guess we'll know more when we record the podcast next weekend. We'll talk about the post-QPR reaction. Who knows? Hopefully we'll be looking at new owners and 3 points on the board by then, which would be an incredibly welcome development at the club. Okay, fantastic. So just to finish things off, Chris, it's been very enjoyable, very interesting listening to you talk about that. People can still purchase your book online, I noticed. Who Put the Ball in the Munich Net by Chris Flanagan. Highly recommended for anyone with an interest in Wanderers or in football in general. It's certainly something to kick back with on your holidays and have a read of on your sunbed and just remember what it was like for football to be fun, because Christ, it seems like it hasn't been fun for a hell of a long time. So we're very, very grateful for you coming on there. Would you mind just giving people an idea where they can find you on social media to talk to you about Wanderers or anything else they may wish to?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at CFlanaganFFT. So yeah, by all means, feel free to send me a message on there. And I'll be at QPR on Saturday and hoping that somehow we can get a result and at least give ourselves a small chance.
Fingers crossed. Will, over to you for the closing, mate.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, so you can find all our ramblings on the Line of the Honesty website, and obviously the updates on Twitter, and potentially if we get to the courtroom, then you can follow all those on there. I'm sure myself and Ian will both be in attendance should it come to that. Obviously you can find the podcast on there as well, and feel free to leave us a review on iTunes if you feel generous enough. Chris, where can they find you on social media, if anywhere?
Absolutely nowhere, mate.
Fair enough. That's a great answer. You can find me on WI1LJ. Hopefully you can sort of have some sort of updates on what's going on at the minute on there. If there's nothing else left to say, then it's time to say goodbye. Say goodbye, Chris Manning.
Goodbye, Chris Manning.
Goodbye, Chris Flanagan.
Goodbye, thank you very much.
And it's goodbye from me, Set Lat V.